Hi, welcome to Lights, Camera, Author. I'm Jim Juno, and this is a show where we talk with authors who write books about classic Hollywood, music, entertainment, and anything in between. And if you hear some band music or some people talking, quick explanation, we are coming to you from Baltimore, Maryland this time instead of Richmond, Virginia. And this is the media room for the CIAA basketball tournament, which is going on this week in Baltimore. So don't be put off if you hear some band music or people cheering. That's just going on out on the field or on the court rather. And I have with me today a pair of authors. Their names, Murray Pomerantz and Matthew Solomon, and they have a new book which came out the 1st of February called The Biggest Thing in Show Business, Living It Up with Martin and Lewis. Murray and Matthew, thank you for being on Lights, Camera, Author.
Thanks for
Nice
having
to be
us,
here.
Jim. Yeah, nice to be here.
Martin and Lewis, this is one of my favorite acts, and I read a lot of the book, being that my job is taking me all over the place this week, wasn't able to finish it. But Martin and Lewis was one of my favorite acts. They broke up before I was born, but through the magic of television and now the internet, I was able to see a lot of their performances. And I think people may have forgotten just how big the comedy team of Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis were from 1946 up until they broke up in 1956. Is that right?
Well, one of the interesting things about the world we're living in is that the social media and the internet have essentially combined with news coverage. Your picture just went
That's
off, but
okay.
you're still there. Combined with news coverage to make a net that goes around the world, which comes into people's homes. And so in a way, the idea of show business as it existed back in the 1940s and 1950s has changed because virtually everything is show business for people now, and they don't really isolate the entertainment sector as something on its own, but it was, and these guys were the kings.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about not just movies, but television, radio, comic books, all kinds of consumer items. I mean, they really were the biggest thing in show business,
And
bar
that
none.
exactly. And if my recollection is correct, or they were the last of the great comedy teams. I mean, you had Laurel and Hardy back in the 20s and 30s, and then you had Abbott and Costello during the war years. Then came Martin and Lewis, and I guess to a later extent, maybe the team of Allen and Rossi, Steve Rossi and Marty Allen.
I was going to mention Alan and Rossi. Yeah, they weren't on that level.
Right, they were not on the level of Martin and Lewis. The last of the great comedy teams, though, was actually Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis.
I think you're right. Stiller and Mira is another one. I mean, there were people who got together in duos and performed, but
Hope and Crosby.
very isolated too, comparatively.
Part of what our argument is that somehow this kind of alchemical combination of these two performers created a kind of magic that was really, both of them were superstars in their own right individually, but somehow the combination of these two performers at this particular point in history was kind of nothing short of explosive.
They were playing with their culture, not only in their culture, but with their culture. A lot of takes on the culture. And I think the book makes kind of clear that the culture in 1940s and 1950s in North America was nothing like the culture today. So there were all kinds of nervous strains, you might want to call them, or pockets of problems, or anxieties flowing out of the war that just aren't there now. Things have changed. There are different anxieties today.
I'm glad you mentioned that because in your book, you talk about America coming out of World War II, and the formation of Martin and Lewis coincides almost a year after the end of World War II in 19. They got together in, I believe, July 1946,
July 25th. Yep.
July 25th, 1946, and of course, World War II ended 1945. America was changed culturally by the war. The world was changed culturally by the war. But, and that, do you think that culture helped form Martin and Lewis?
I think there are best guides to post-war culture. Again, I did not live through that. But my sense is that they're probably two of the best guides to what was getting stirred up in that decade-long period, what the culture was interested in, nervous about, hesitant about. They kind of were able to poke at it in all these kinds of ways. But again, I didn't live through it. I have to defer to those that did.
No, I did actually, but I was quite young because I was born in 1946. So I was probably exposed to them when I was about 6 years old or so, shortly after they started, maybe early 50s. And for a kid, what they did was, you ought to, maybe the audience won't immediately go to this, so I should say it because it's in the book. They never did blue.
That's
That's
right.
the language for smutty, dirty, filthy, all that stuff. Never. They never did blue. They didn't want to go there. That wasn't the style of their comedy. They did more person-to-person shtick, more personality shtick. But when you looked at them, you kind of had this visual sense of two weird types batting back and forth against one another. You didn't always understand the language as a reference to cultural implications that we now would pick up very easily. In fact, we do pick it up when we write the book.
Yes, and then that's an amazing thing. You know, you write about it. It's a sense of innocence that they brought. You know, that, of course, you said they didn't work dirty. They didn't work blue. They never had. They didn't even use women as sexual objects.
Oh, yes, they did.
Okay, they did.
Oh, yes, they did. They
Okay.
used women as sexual objects, but they used women as sexual objects the way women were generally thought of. In that era. I got a puppy here. The
I got a band here.
women's liberation movement in America kind of took form mostly around the early 1960s. Marley, stop! 63 is when Betty Friedan's book was published. So before that, you had a certain kind of gender hierarchy that was just absolutely commonplace.
Do you think that you know, like you mentioned, these are two guys. If you look at them on the surface, they could not, I love your dog, by the way, but
Well, he's joining in. Sorry.
let him bark. I mean, my dog always joins us every once in a while, so no problem at all. But if you look at these two guys, you would think there's no two more different kind of guys to form a team than Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis. And somehow it worked.
Yeah, I think that was one of the dynamic features of this duo is their trafficking in opposites and really playing off each other very self-consciously about how different they were. But it's also the dynamics of the buddy film, right? Where we kind of believe that these two are not just fellow performers, but they're friends. Part of the act was the sense that these guys are really having a good time together. They like each other's company. This isn't just about making a paycheck. And I think that resonated with the audiences, certainly resonated with me as a viewer the first time I, watched Martin and Lewis movies.
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't just cardboard cutouts punching each other, which was a very standard kind of thing. Even if you look at, say, Laurel and Hardy or Evan Costello, those guys, they were classic, but you didn't always have the feeling they were buddies. You had the feeling that they were two contrasting types who would go at each other. So that Punch and Judy, if you like. But Martin and Lewis cultivated a kind of weird audience reception of them as a kind of quote married unquote. They were bonded at the hip. It's kind of interesting. It started. They were both at a nightclub performing one after the other, very different acts. Dean Martin was crooning with a much bigger nose and slick back long hair. And Jerry Lewis was doing what was called at the time a record act. There would be a record playing off off the stage, and he would be mimicking the record. And you could do it, he could do it in such a way as to get a lot of laughs. And then they sort of fell together. They just literally fell together at that nightclub.
That was the 500 Club, I believe, right?
Yeah, it just happened. It could easily have not happened.
From what I read about doing some research into them, it was like you said, it was by accident. I mean, one a singer didn't show up, I believe, and also I think they said that Dean Martin, they told him, need to go on with this guy, Jerry Lewis.
There's
They had
different
no idea.
stories. There's different versions of this kind of origin myth, but it almost kind of started as a prank, as Dean messing with the record and Jerry forced to respond to the skipping of the record. And so there's a kind of playfulness, there's a kind of irreverence, there's a kind of like whatever the rules are, we're going to break them. That was, I think, their originary kind of ethos, like whatever you're expecting, we're going to turn that on its head.
The book is set up essentially on that tone. And I guess if you were asking in one sentence what we're trying to say, it's that they were responding to the rules of the culture at the time. And the book tries to show you not only what they did, but what the culture was, so you can see that tension.
And what amazes me is, and this is something I didn't know except from reading your book. Yes, they were big. They were cross, or as we would say nowadays, cross-platform or multi-platform performers. But they were also, what's the right word? They promoted their. There was a lot of inventory, a lot of collectibles nowadays that had Martin and Lewis' name on it, which was something new. You didn't see that before.
Yeah, they really understood the power of the hustle, right? Which is you're always hustling product, you're always selling, you're always trying to make a buck. They understood that what they were was self-promoters. Their programming on television was sponsored by, a consumer product. And they really just kind of embodied that, which we kind of take for granted now, but I think at the time, it was a little bit different the way they were so relentlessly self-promotional. And like you said, across platforms, across commodities, Martin and Lewis tape, Martin and Lewis puppets, like you name it, there's a product out there that was branded with their images, with their names. And they were obviously getting paid on every single one of these opportunities.
If you look at the culture today and the way known stars are used to sell products, you'll see there's almost always a kind of abashed, embarrassed denial of what we're doing. In other words, I'm selling the product, but I take it seriously and you should take it seriously too. So don't mock me for selling the product. Whereas what Dean and Jerry did was to actually go face forward into the camera and say, I don't know the commercial, the people who make this toothpaste, they really want me to sell it to you, so I'm selling it to you. It was very confrontational. And so they were actually putting light on the commercial enterprise, not just using it.
And
There's
it
a
also
couple of great examples where they break frame, right? Where Jerry says, brush your teeth with Ajax, where they start pitching golf balls, which they're not there to sell. And so there's these great moments when they break frame and everybody around them is getting nervous and getting very bent out of shape because they're messing with the money. They're messing with what the sponsors have dictated, what the sponsors want.
And naming the sponsor out front, Colgate should say this, Colgate won't be happy with us for this. Who names the sponsor of a show today? Boy, oh boy, you just would never know
Oh,
who's paying for this stuff.
that's right. I mean, Colgate Palmolive or Colgate Comedy Hour was what they were best known for on TV, I believe.
Yeah, and after that, you see, we had a flood of hour-long television variety shows that went on starring famous movie people like the Doris Day Show, but there were many, many, many. The Jane Wyman Show went on and on and on, but they were all named after the person. So the Doris Day Show was the Doris Day Show. It wasn't the sponsor's Doris Day Show.
There was one show, I believe, after them, and it was on in the 60s. And it's not very well known nowadays, but it was called, I think, Kraft Suspense Theater or Kraft Mystery Theater, something like that.
Right. Yes, that's correct.
And that's the last one
But that
I
was a
can.
serious show. Nobody in that show ever turned around and said, "Hey, Kraft, what a strange guy."
It was a very serious show. And the amazing thing, though, is that they went on radio first, and then they went to TV. I believe in 48, Ed Sullivan had his, was it the Ed Sullivan Show? Toast of the Town, was that the first one they were on?
I think it was. Did they do Burl before that, Matt?
I mean, I think they did them all. I mean, one of the things that we tried to do in the book was we didn't want to be chronological. We didn't want to tell this narrative of rise and fall or whatever. We really deliberately set to kind of throw chronology out the door, to disregard what was first, what was last, and really just kind of try and get in there and get in the mix. And we wanted the design of the book to push back on what a book looks like. There are no chapters. Some sections are a couple pages, some sections are longer. We really wanted to push back on just what's your idea of a book? We're going to try and trouble that just a little bit. And to us, that's in the spirit of what they were doing. That, yeah, you could do a chronological story of Martin and Lewis and start at the beginning and end at the end, but that's not really true to their spirit, at least in our view.
Not meaning to contradict you, but I don't think we were trying to do this just a little bit. I actually think when we were, we did this as a COVID project. We had both been wanting to do Martin and Lewis for 10 years, and then COVID happened, and we were both sitting around trapped in front of a computer one summer. So we decided to open a Google document and write this book simultaneously together, correcting one another's sentences and things. So we did all that. But we intended when we made this book to throw it in the face of the reader, like this is very not the kind of thing you're used to getting when you buy a book. For instance, the introduction is not the first thing you get. I mean, that kind of thing. We just muddled everything up. We wanted to get the tone of the Martin and Lewis performance, and we somehow wanted to have the book be that tone.
It's kind of
One of the
funny.
titles we threw out was In Your Face with Martin and Lewis. And that was very much the idea, right? Of like they were getting in your face, and we wanted to get in the reader's face.
Somehow that was felt to be a tiny bit confrontational for 2024. And so we made it living it up. But we did mean in your face, because they were in your face.
That was frowned upon in that establishment, wasn't it? It's funny you mentioned that because when I first opened up, I had the electronic version of the book, the Kindle version, and I opened it up, and of course there is no introduction, so I began reading, and I thought, wait a minute, did I miss a page or a section
Perfect.
here?
Perfect. Perfect.
Mission accomplished. Mission accomplished. Right? You
it
turn on the set whenever, right? You just, oh, they've started, right? You just jump right in. That's the idea. Like
Exactly.
Jerry is pouring a pail of water on Dean's head, and that's where you come in. So you're wondering, oh my God, so what could have led to this, right? But you'll never know because it's live TV, so it's gone.
That's right. It's
No tape,
all.
there's no VHS, there's no tape, there's no
No.
kinescope occasionally, sometimes later for the West Coast, but there's nothing you can get hold of.
Right. I
No.
mean, it's all. I mean, once it's gone, it's gone. And
Bingo.
it's a real shame too. Let's touch on this for a second, because yes, when it's live TV, it goes out as it is. How were you able to find information, given that the live TV, a lot of live TV wasn't saved?
So a lot of the broadcasts were recorded for the West Coast, at least for the Colgate Comedy Hour. So we actually had access to quite a few of the broadcasts, which have been kind of anthologized and put on YouTube by various kind of collectors. There's no authorized kind of version, but collectors have kind of made this stuff available. And I would urge you and your listeners to go and look at some of those Colgate Comedy Hour episodes. They're really ahead of their time, really extraordinarily reflexive, extraordinarily self-conscious. All the stuff we credit, later filmmakers with doing, they were doing back in the early 50s. So I think those broadcasts are pretty extraordinary.
But your contemporary consumer pop culture is addicted to irony. Like there's irony everywhere you look. All the storylines are ironically composed, performances ironic. There's always a kind of conflict between what something looks like and what you're supposed to believe is really there. With Martin Lewis, they mostly worked without irony. It was very face to face. So things would simply happen directly. And I think the most assaulting quality of their work for the contemporary viewer is just literally the in-your-faceness of it. That it's not cool. You know, it's not cool, it's not polite, it's not snarky, it's not ironic, it's none of these things. It's bam.
Here it is.
Here it is.
It's amazing. A lot of the stuff they did was improvised, or at least they gave the impression it was improvised. But I did see in my when I was reading along that Norman Lear was actually one of their best, one of their most used writers.
Early on, that's right.
And so that was quite a combination, Norman Lear and Martin Lewis.
The skits were written, and I imagine they were rehearsed only enough to make sure the cameras were in the right place and the lighting was right. So maybe one rehearsal, I would guess. They wouldn't want to have the freshness wear off. But everything they did before, after, and in the middle of all the skits was all just happening.
Dean
But they had
Martin,
some
yeah.
great collaborators, right? You know, Norman Lear is just one of a long list of great collaborators. Frank Tashlin, the director, all these co-stars that were kind of bouncing off them and their various performances. So one of the things we wanted to try and do in the book was to give some attention, not just to the headliners, but to all the other kind of great minds, great performers, great writers that were part of this kind of Martin and Lewis multiverse that don't always get mentioned, that don't always get their due, but were really part of this universe and an integral part.
There was a very long discussion of a sequence in Artisan Models to sort of bring to the surface the writing, the camera positions, and the director. And then there's a very long discussion of Living It Up in terms of some of the supporting players that were involved with him in that movie to try to break open how they chose those people and what was going on.
It's interesting that you mentioned that they didn't do a lot of rehearsing. That seems to be something that Dean Martin brought with him to his TV show later on in the 60s, where or in the early 70s, where he would only work one day a week. He let everybody else work and set everything up on his I think of the Dean Martin show. And he only worked one day a week, right?
I mean, I think part of what we're wondering about is how much of the Dean Martin persona of how much of that was actually a really skillful act that was actually pretty well rehearsed and well performed. So it's really hard, I think, to sort out the mythology of Dean, who was presumably always drinking on the set, who was presumably always a bit tipsy, and what we see as some pretty incredible and virtuosic performance, comic timing, physical comedy, that would belie that stereotype or that mythology of Dean, you know, just showing up and doing his thing. Really remarkable if that was in fact true.
And Jerry, you know, again, a stereotype of somebody who was completely, his nervous system was just frayed. You know, he went off on every direction at once. But in his interviews, his serious interviews, what you see is a very reflective, intelligent, calm, deliberative personality. So we're looking at performance here.
In 1956, when they ended their partnership, they still had $4 million in gigs, so to speak, performances that they didn't do.
But they had to pay it.
They did have to pay it, yes. And I was just wondering, did they split up because of the two people, Martin and Lewis, were just getting to be too big, or was the world changing around them? Because 56 is definitely different than 46.
I'm
That's
curious
interesting.
what Murray's answer is, so I want to hear
I'm just
Murray's
no, I'm
answer.
just thinking that last night I was watching the ending of A Funny Girl. And that's a movie about a certain kind of myth that a marriage just cannot survive the tensions of a career split when one person becomes so very big and so successful and the other one doesn't. That myth is really out there around a lot these days, but I don't think that's what it was.
Oh,
You
okay.
don't. Yeah.
Matthew
What
went
do you
the
think it was?
Murray, do you, oh, is that for Murray? Okay.
That's not
Yeah, yeah. I'm curious what Murray thinks, because I think, you know,
unrequited love.
I just think there was a 10-year statute of limitations. There was a 10-year expiration date, right? Like, if you're going to go that hard every day in every medium, well, it's just unsustainable ultimately. 10 years, that's an awful long time, actually. So I just think they just reached the end of what they were capable of doing, what was humanly possible. If you think about all of the stuff and the physical toll that it took on both these individuals, I mean, Jerry was having physical problems, Dean was having all kinds of personal problems. And so I think, wow, they were incredibly lucky to make it 10 years.
You know, in terms of the myth and history of it all, the only thing in my lifetime that was as shocking as a cultural event, was the breakup of the Beatles.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, I was
When
thinking the same
that
thing.
when that happened, the response was then and still is today, what? Why? How? Nobody could understand it because they were flying. And that's what happened with Martin and Lewis. It was absolutely a shock. Nobody knew what to make of it, and they still don't.
Well, I tell you what, I really appreciate both of you. The authors' names are Murray Pomeranz and Matthew Solomon. The book is called The Biggest Thing in Show Business, Living It Up with Martin and Lewis. Matthew and Murray, thank you again for being on Lights, Camera, Author today.
Thank you, Jim.
Our pleasure. You've been a great audience.